Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. If someone asked you to list life's biggest decisions, you would probably start with two things. One, picking a career, and the other, picking a life partner. However, our guest for this hour, Richard Florida, says there is another decision that has an equal, if not greater, effect on our overall life outcome, and that is where to live. This morning, we'll talk about some of what you will find in his most recent book. The title is Who's Your City? He writes that growing numbers of Americans have the chance to choose a city that truly fits their needs. We'll talk a little bit about how to find the place that's best for you, and also maybe a little bit about how that can change over the life course. And of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest is Professor of Business and Creativity at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. Before that, he also held professorships at George Mason University and Carnegie Mellon University, and also taught as visiting professor at Harvard. He is a former senior scientist with the Gallup Organization. He is also the academic director of the Martin Prosperity Institute there at University of Toronto. People, I think, perhaps will know him for an earlier book that was a big bestseller. That was The Rise of the Creative Class. And certainly you can continue to find that in the library or the bookstore, along with the new one. And that is published by Basic Books. As we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief just so that we can keep moving along. But anyone who's listening is certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point there, questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Florida, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate it. I'm not exactly sure where to start here because there are a number of ideas that overlap, and certainly I think some of what you write about in Who's Your City goes back to some of your previous writing. Maybe the thing to do is to talk a little bit about the major economic units that now drive the world. As you describe in the book, and that is we've gone beyond the idea that cities are important. Cities, yes, continue to be important, and certain cities around the globe are very important. But you have expanded this to talk about the idea of what you call the mega region, the fundamental economic unit of our time. Let's talk about that. What is a mega region? What does that mean?
Well, good morning, David, and good morning, everybody listening. You know, there are really two primary reasons that I wrote the book, and we'll get to the second one in a minute. Mm-hmm. The first one is, you know, I've been studying globalization. I did a big study for the Sloan Foundation on globalization in the late 1990s. And as a person who's an urban planner and an economic geography, for a long time we've heard things like, well, you know, we have a telegraph machine, the world's going to spread out, and we have railway cars and railroads, and the world's going to spread out. And we have all, you know, trains, planes, and automobiles, and the world's going to get bigger, and people are going to move out. And then finally, you know, with the rise of the computer and telecommunications and the internet, we have this kind of idea, and I talk about it in the book, you know, distance is dead, mm-hmm. Place no longer matters. And then, you know, I think the biggest construct of all is this notion that the world is flat. You know, Tom Friedman, who's a fantastic writer, and I love his book, but the notion that the world is flat, that somehow, you know, with all these advances in communications and technology and transportation, we can, you know, move out to the hillside, live on a mountaintop, live near green space, near a pond, near an ocean, near a lake. And what we did, very simply, is we took a very hard look at that notion. And with a very, very smart group of people, including my colleagues here at the Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto, we took those maps of the world at night, and the viewers can imagine those. You know, if you think about how that looks with all the lights kind of shining, and we said, let's look at where population really is, let's look at where economic activity really is, and let's look at where innovation occurs. And what we found is that there are really 40 mega regions that drive the world economy. Now, you're in one, and we can talk more about the one that goes kind of from Chicago to Champaign, stretches over to Minneapolis, and it goes over to Pittsburgh, and that's one of the world's biggest. a great geographer named Sean Gottman a long time ago called it Chi Pits, kind of a cute name considering that I lived in Pittsburgh for 17 years. But these 40 mega regions have about 18% of the world's population. They produce more than two-thirds of the world's economic output and about 9 in 10 of the world's innovations. And lest you think we're competing with places like China and India or Russia, one of the things the book points out and our research finds is that we are not competing with countries. We are competing with a couple of mega regions, you know, the one that runs from kind of Bangalore to Mumbai to Delhi, and the other one in China that runs kind of from Beijing to Shanghai. And, you know, just to put a quick, to summarize this, bring it all, wrap it around, I was talking to one of my Chinese students about the importance of these big, you know, super cities or mega regions. And he said, well, Rich, he actually is very humble. He said, Professor Florida, you know, as a Chinese student would, and academics listening and will understand. He said, well, Professor Florida, I live in Shanghai, and in Shanghai, the average household lives, and he said, with all due respect, better than you would. But the people outside of Shanghai live in pre-civilized conditions. So what we like to say is the world may be partly flat, but it's also very, very spiky. And these mega units, these 40 mega units, are the real economic drivers of the future.
Yeah. And that's, I guess that gets to an important idea that says that areas of population concentration can be, often are, places where there is a lot of prosperity. They have booming economies. There's a lot of innovation. It's a place where smart people are and smart people want to go. That does not necessarily mean that places where there are high concentrations of population are going to have all those things.
No, you have huge, huge, huge concentrations of populations. These megacities in the Middle East, in Asia, and especially Africa and Latin America, which have 20, 30, 40 million people but don't have a lot of economic activity. And I point that out in the book, and I'm very worried, personally very worried about this concentration of economic activity. But what I say is that there, these 40 of these mega regions, they have 5 to 10 million people minimum. Some have 50 million. And the ones that really are driving the world economy produce at least 100 billion. Some of them produce 2 trillion in economic activity. So it's really these large economic aggregations. And in fact, what the book suggests, you know, according to the UN, the United Nations, this is the first year in human history when more than 50% of all people live in urban agglomerations. And then what we're saying is those urban agglomerations that account for less than 20% of us account for 90% of innovations and two-thirds of economic activity. And I'm really worried about that because, you know, in the United States, we were used to being in a place which had a wide range of thriving cities. And you know, where I grew up in the Newark, New Jersey area, Champaign, Urbana, the Dakotas, even in the South, certainly greater New York or greater Chicago or greater San Francisco had more wealth, but you weren't on a different playing field than people in, even the poorest people were sort of still in a modern economy. What we're seeing now in the emerging economies is spiky concentrations of wealth, which are people are as wealthy as you or I, you know, and a professor at the U, and where people, in the words of my Chinese students, on the outskirts of Shanghai live in pre-civilized conditions. So it's not only economic inequality that we're dealing with. One of the points the book makes is that it's geographic inequality. And the other thing the book says, and it says this in quite a troubled way, it's not lauding this, it's saying we have to think about this, that in order to be economically successful today or have socioeconomic mobility, increasingly that may well require geographic mobility. I'm not lauding that. I'm just saying to folks, you need to be well aware of it, because as the world becomes more global yet more concentrated, the people who can move have an enormous advantage over those who may be rooted, or worse yet, those who don't have the resources and might be stuck in the places that they were born.
Real quick, let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Richard Florida. He's professor of business and creativity at University of Toronto, where he's also academic director of the Martin Prosperity Institute. He is author of a recently published book, Who's Your City? The subtitle, How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. It's published by Basic Books. He's also author of an earlier book that got a lot of attention, sold very well, The Rise of the Creative Class. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So again, just go back to pick up on the idea that it's an important one. I think that in spite of the realities of modern transportation and communication systems, and that idea some people have was, well, as far as my work prospects at least are concerned, I could live anywhere. Your argument is, well, you know, that's not quite true. A place does matter. All places are not the same in terms of either their economic potential or their personality. And that's something I'm sure we'll talk about. The question there, I guess, is, though, the next question to go to is, well, look at these places where the economies are booming and there's a lot of innovation, these places that are fundamental economic units now. The people there, why is it that these places are the way that they are? And I guess that the answer to the question is the people there.
Well, it's a great question, and the book really talks about a woman who in her later years was always my idol, a role model, and became a mentor to me in her 80s, the great Jane Jacobs. And, you know, she advised me. She had left New York and moved to Toronto. She advised me personally to move to Toronto. But, you know, for a long time, people thought economic growth came from technology. And then really, really smart people, principally at the University of Chicago, but also at Stanford, said, no. Economic growth comes from these concentrations of highly skilled people or human capital. Jane, who didn't finish college and never went to graduate school, never taught at university, actually figured out where economic growth really comes from. And in her book, The Economy of Cities, she wrote another book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, but in a book where she talks about economic growth, the economy of cities, she said, if we really want to understand where economic growth comes from, it comes not from companies locating in a place, but from people. And the great University of Chicago economist, Robert Lucas, who won the Nobel Prize, when he won the Nobel Prize, said that this woman, Jane Jacobs, should receive a Nobel Prize, even though she wasn't an economist, didn't have a graduate degree, because she had unlocked the real secret to economic growth, which I call in the book the clustering force. When people come together, it can be in a smaller place like Champaign or Mana, but in a big agglomeration like Chicago that's kind of swallowed up the whole region and this massive mega region. What really drives the economic growth process and which enables people to spend a larger amount of money to buy a home and for the cost of living is the fact that when people come together in cities, two things happen. One, all of our productivity goes up because we're surrounded by other people who have complementary skills. You know, they're doing things which make us more productive. We have, to use an academic phrase, a kind of geographic division of labor. The other thing she talks about, and she gives this fantastic example, you know, writing 30 years ago, of the woman who invented the brassiere, talking about how she was kind of in New York City and wanted to invent a lady's undergarment and had all of these different inputs and new people who could help her assemble this thing. But she says, if you want to understand where innovation comes from, innovation doesn't necessarily come from innovative companies. It comes from these concentrations of people, whether those are in the Champaign-Urbana region inventing, you know, semiconductors, or whether they're in, you know, this technology complex called the Silicon Valley today. Those are the kinds of things that cities do. And in some sense, what the book really says is behind economic growth is not just companies and nations. There's this thing called a city and its larger mega region that are really the driving force of economic growth. And we just have to be aware of it. And, you know, for folks paying attention to this election, it's interesting. Of all the three major candidates remaining, none of them, and I have my own preference, none of them are really talking about the role of cities and mega regions as engines of economic growth. So I think it's an important issue for the country and an issue that's time has come.
Hmm. This is, in a sense, a kind of a side street, but I imagine it is something that you've thought about. The way that you talk about the growth of these mega regions and the potential for continued growth, I find myself wondering, is there a limit? Of course, some people argue that there are and should be limits to growth, but is that kind of explosive growth that we have seen in various places you're talking about, and you chart them out in the book if people want to see what they are, they are there. Do you think that that is sustainable, or is there? Do we come to a problem at some point?
Well, I think there's two issues there, and let me start with the kind of what is and then what I hope will be. First, what is. There's a group of brilliant scientists, physicists, biologists, economists, geographers at the Santa Fe Institute. The Santa Fe Institute in New Mexico is sort of a collection of the greatest geniuses in the world. They had read my earlier book, Rise of the Creative Class, and they came up with this idea, which I talk about in Hoosier City, the new book, of urban metabolism. And basically what they said is there's only one reason that these places can grow really, really big. It's because they have a rate of innovation, or what they call a kind of urban geographic metabolism, which scales. In other words, it gets faster and faster and faster. And the book explains the technical details if folks are interested, but the point is, that's why we feel our pace of life speeding up so much, that we live a 24/7 existence, and we want work-life balance. The pace of life in these places, just to become productive and innovative, has sped up. Here's the what I would like to be, and one of the reasons I read the book, and one of the reasons I direct this wonderful institute, the Prosperity Institute, note its name, Prosperity Institute. We want to foster a shared prosperity in Toronto. Every major period of economic transformation comes with increasing concentration of wealth and innovation. If you think back 100 or 150 years ago, with the rise of the industrial economy, we had almost a similar kind of phenomenon, that wealth was concentrated in a capitalist or robber baron class, and it was concentrated in big cities of the time, Detroit, Chicago, Pittsburgh, and their European equivalents. What the book is saying is, if we don't come to the realization that this rise of an idea-driven or creative economy is concentrating wealth and economic activity, we won't be able to deal with it. If we continue to believe the mythology that the world is flat and everyone can plug and play, 6 billion people from wherever they are, if we come to accept that kind of market-driven mentality, we will never understand the kind of gross unevenness. The other thing I talk about in the book is that this is what the political polarization is about. It's a class divide. This is what our culture war is about. It's fundamentally a class divide. And what the book says is, we're going to have to build new institutions. We're going to have to build new institutions globally. Mayors can't do this alone. City councilors can't do this alone. Governors can try, but they can't do it. We're going to have to build global institutions like the New Deal. You know, what Franklin Roosevelt did with the New Deal is, he said, working people should have the shot to participate and buy a home and send their kids to college and have a good way of life. We have to do the same thing with the creative economy. And what really, really troubles me is, I can't find a national political figure worldwide who wants to engage in this conversation. And the book, the kind of first major part of the book, is devoted to saying, we need to have this conversation, because in a spiky world, we need to build institutions that can help people outside of the spikes be productive, be effective, and have a high quality of life. If not, the unevenness we're going to face economically and geographically is going to be unlike anything the world has ever seen.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the questions that was in my mind as well, is when you observe this kind of phenomenon where we have the movement of large numbers of highly skilled, highly educated people to these small number of metro regions, because that's the place they can use their skills and realize their economic potential, and you get this effect that it builds on itself. Clearly, that must be happening at the expense of other regions, because they are losing whatever kind of talent and skill and highly educated people they have. If they say, well, if I stay here where I am right now, I'm not going to be able to be what I can and make as much money as I would like to and live in the way that I would like to, then I'm going to have to go to one of these other places. I mean, does it indeed have to happen at the expense of this? Is some regions gain, somebody else's loss?
No, it doesn't. And at the Prosperity Institute, and we're actually trying to do this in Toronto and Ontario, we're trying to make the case that every single human being is creative. Every human being has creative talent that can lead to productivity and improvement. And we're encouraging people not only to work in smaller towns and to help bolster those towns, but really to undertake what we call a service economy strategy. So many towns want to have a strong technology industry or a strong culture industry. What we're saying is, there's 45% of all of our jobs are in the service economy. Why can't we make those jobs better? And I just want to give folks out there the clear example of kind of where they live. You know, the Chi-Pitz region that stretches, as I said, from Chicago westward out past through Milwaukee, parts of Wisconsin, out to Minneapolis, down southward, well into Indiana, and then over through Detroit and Cleveland out to Pittsburgh. 46 million people, $1.6 trillion in economic activity. It's the third largest mega region in the world. Only the East Coast, New York Corridor, Boston, Washington, and Greater Tokyo are bigger. And if you think about what's driven growth in that mega region and what's really caused the growth of Chicago, and I know we have listeners in Chicago, mm-hmm. what Chicago has done is consolidate so many of the functions that used to be done in Pittsburgh and Detroit and Akron and Toledo and Milwaukee. And, you know, every time my wife's family is from the greater Detroit area, every time we go to visit, you know, her friends and her brother and sister's friends are moving to Chicago and coming back from the holidays from Chicago, the Chicago metro. In a sense, the core of these mega regions are sucking in so much talent because they're consolidating functions. And no, I don't think that's the way it has to be. I think that's the way it is in the absence of any kind of political, governmental, or institutional innovation. We could design a world which created better, smaller-scale cities, which allowed people to have affordable housing. They didn't have to pay an arm and a leg to live downtown Chicago or downtown New York. We can design a world and people in the service economy get better wages. And what the book is trying to say is it's time to think about what that darn world's going to look like. Because if we don't take charge of it, if we don't try to control it, it will control us. The negatives that I see are not just economic inequality. I see a country in the United States that's so polarized, where people outside the mega regions and the spikes are fearful, they're insecure, they're anxious, they're worried, and they're lashing out in anger at the communities of people who live in urban areas. I see growing culture divide between people generationally in terms of sexual orientation, race, and ethnicity. But if you look at the emerging economies, I think the spiky world is what produces what we see as growing tribalism and ultimately terrorism. So I think if we don't understand this unevenness and we continue to believe that somehow globalization will save us and allow everyone to participate, it's in fact allowing a fortunate few, and that few may be several hundred million people, but out of 6 billion people, it's allowing a fortunate minority to have higher well-being and higher affluence and wealth at the expense of a growing and growing majority who are frankly, most of them are just scared and insecure about how they fit in.
Hmm. Our guest this morning is Richard Florida. He's an urban planner, economic geographer, someone who in part is well known for having written about what it is that makes cities vital, exciting places to be. He is well known for his national bestseller, The Rise of the Creative Class, and has a new book out. The title of that book is Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. It's published by Basic Books. That book is out now, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore, library, if you'd like to read it. He is professor of business and creativity at the University of Toronto. He has also taught at George Mason, at Carnegie Mellon, and also at Harvard and MIT. He's a former senior scientist with the Gallup Organization. He is also the academic director of the Martin Prosperity Institute there at University of Toronto. Questions welcome. People can just help us by trying to be brief. That way we can get in as many as possible. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some callers here, starting with Effingham. This is line 4. Hello.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. The population explosion, the tracking of wealth to, in the U.S., I think I heard right on Channel 12, 0.5% own the bulk of it. We are one of the lower populated areas in the world. Based on those conditions, how do you propose to take from power the bourgeois class who own everything? And how would you distribute that? What's the ramifications of a velvet revolution or one that comes out the end of a gun?
Well, I think we're there. I think there is enough anger. You know, Tom Frank wrote this wonderful book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And he said the people in Kansas were misled. They weren't voting with their interests. People in Kansas are scared. They're terrified of how they fit into this world. And you know, Kansas is a metaphor for so many of us. And they're really, really, at any time of anxiety like this, you know, social categories like sexual orientation, blame the gay people. Ethnicity. Blame the immigrants. Blame low-income African-American people. And that becomes kind of a disastrously noxious brew. And so people, when they get scared and angry, and you know, instead of trying to think about a future for our economy, they're kind of saying, well, bring back America's golden past with family values and stable jobs. That's gone, and it's tragic it's gone. My father had only an eighth grade education. He worked in a factory his entire life, putting us through school. But his job, he told me when I started that job, it was a terrible job with low wages, but then Franklin Roosevelt came along and there was unionization, and all of a sudden I had a good job. What would we try to do? We're actually doing it, and one of the reasons I moved to Toronto and Ontario is we have a premier, which is our governor. I'm going to go meet with him later today. And we have a mayor here, David Miller, Premier Dalton McGuinty and a mayor, David Miller, who are really concerned about doing this. And what they're saying is, it's fine that people make money, and it's fine that we have big companies in Toronto and Ontario, but regular folks need a shot. And that's why we didn't call it the Creativity Institute or the Innovation Institute. We picked the word prosperity because we said, we want every single Torontonian and every single Ontarian to be able to share in this prosperity. And what I was saying before is, I really believe the key group that has to share in this prosperity is not just the manufacturing workers like my dad, although they need a better go, the people who toil in the Walmarts and the service economy, those retail shops who cut your hair and mow your lawn and for so many people take care of their kids. This is the group of people, 45%, whose jobs can't be moved offshore, and who deserve to have a job at least as good, if not better, than my dad. So we're hard at work at it here. It's going to take a long time because this is a hard problem and it's a global problem. But we're trying to build models right here in where we live and how to do this. And I think you're right. It's absolutely critical that we not just talk about this, but try to develop pathways and practices to solve it.
So just, I think the caller puts his finger on an important issue, certainly here in the United States, and that is income inequality inequality of prospects. You'd think that that's something, maybe it's not something that you're going to erase. There's always going to be some kind of spread. Do you think that it can be, the gap between the people on the top and the bottom can at least be narrowed significantly?
Yes, and I think the key to that is to make it a basic human right. Just like we have a basic right to vote, freedom of speech, a basic human right that every human being has the right to use their God-given talent, the right to self-express, and the right to do their passion for their work. Yes, and we work all around the world. We find that here in Ontario, also in the Scandinavian countries, there is fabulous interest. But the other thing I just want to add, David and Effingham, is that it's not only economic inequality anymore. It's spatial and geographic inequality. The life chances of someone at the core of a mega region, whether that's Greater Chicago or Greater Shanghai, are fundamentally different than someone outside that mega region. And what we're trying to say is, we are compounding economic inequality by giving it a geographic dimension that it never had before. You know, you could live in Pittsburgh and you could achieve some kind of economic mobility in your town or almost anywhere. But now, increasingly, if you want to be economically mobile, you have to very much think about geographic mobility and the ability to move. You know, that tears communities apart, that tears families apart, and that leads to all kinds of problems with social cohesion, of which the great Harvard professor Robert Putnam has written so eloquently about. So I'm concerned about not only economic inequality. What I'm trying to add to the debate, what the book tries, Hoosier City tries to add to the debate, is it has an increasingly a geographic and spatial or place-based component.
Well, let's talk with someone else. Hoopston is the next caller. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. Joined the conversation rather late, so I apologize ahead of time if you've already covered this. Just a couple of observations from my point of view, and see if your guests want to comment. I did grow up in Chicago, my wife and I did, and we made kind of a life decision when we started our family to move out of the city. We moved about 125 miles south. I've been very fortunate. I have a couple of graduate degrees, and I understand the growth in this industry is primarily in healthcare, which I'm involved with, and my wife is a teacher. So it's been a very good decision for us and very fortunate. But my concern is the people here in the community, the older people speak of, well, you know, we used to do canning or whatever, and I was involved with economic development in the chamber for a while when we first moved here 10 years ago, and I was trying to explain to them, well, you know, those industries are gone, and they're gone forever. And I wanted to kind of get them to think outside of the box, you know, either advanced education or something like that. And what we're facing here is basically a core of elderly people who are going to be here probably until they pass away. But there are no jobs, very few jobs. It's a town of 6,000 people. And my concern is the limited education these people are getting for themselves. And I'm thinking, well, what are you going to be able to do if you either drop out of high school or just get a high school education? You know, you're not going to be prepared for what's coming. And like I said, we moved here. You know, we have a house that we probably could never afford in Chicago and made the decision to raise our kids out of the city, although we like to visit it quite often. But the communities themselves, if they stay with their past, I'm afraid they're doomed, and I'm very concerned about the young people. And I'll go ahead and ring off, and you can comment. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Well, first of all, the first thing I want to say is congratulations on your own move. And this is really the primary reason I wrote the book. And let me talk about that for a minute. We can go back to social issues later. The reason I wrote the book, and it's called Who's Your City, a fairly obvious title when you think about it, the real thing is why the place you choose to live is such an important decision for you. And think about what the caller, folks listening in, just said. I say in the book, 40 million Americans move each year. 15 million of you guys are moving every year outside of the county or state or potentially 1% of us moving abroad. That means we're turning over the entire country in about 20 years if we just take the significant moves. And we're very, very we're most likely to move in our 20s. That's when a third of all people in their 20s are moving each and every year. So what the book says is you're going to have three big moves, just like the caller talked about. You're going to have three big moves in your life. When you graduate college and you're looking to establish your career, but even more importantly, find that special someone, that girl or a boy, who you're going to meet. We have a cool map in the book. We call it the singles map, which actually shows you red dots for the boys, blue dots for the girls, where you can find the best cities for you. The second big move, which the caller just mentioned, which is so important, is what not when you get married, it's when the kids arrive. And what we're telling folks then is now it's time to really think again. If you thought about your move when you graduated college and tried to find the place for you, now when the kids come along, and like the caller said, he and his wife are living in Chicago, they want to have an affordable place, low crime, great safety, great quality of life. Well, just don't think about the house, the suburb 20 miles or 10 miles to your east or west. Think about all the places you might imagine you want to move to and make the best decision for you. Then the third move comes along when the kids leave home. And with this baby boom coming surging, what we're finding is the baby boom are starting to think in a whole new way about empty nester, the empty nester time of their life. They don't want to call it retirement. They want to keep active. And what the book actually does, more importantly, I think, than all the big think it tries to do in kind of positioning all these issues, it says, we can give you a set of tools, whether you're a young person graduating college, you know, mom and dad now with a new family, or mom and dad when the kids have left the house. These big three stages of your life, we can give you a set of tools that you can think about this, and you said it in your intro, you know, we all know how to do that with our career and our jobs and how important it is to find the company and career we love. We all know and have advice about, you know, finding that perfect soulmate or life partner. And what I think this book is the first time someone from my part of the world, geographer, has said, no, this place decision is one of the big three, job, life partner, place. And it tries to give folks who read it and folks who come to the website at whosyourcity.com a set of tools with which to better make that decision. So I just want to congratulate the caller and say, you know, he's gone through this process. He's made a great decision. And I hope that more and more Americans and more people around the world can do the same.
All right. Let's talk again with another caller. And this time the person is in Urbana and line two. Hello. There's a caller there, line two in Urbana. Okay, how about we'll go to line three in Champaign. Hello.
Wow, three has become two. Great. the issue of, I guess I could say, who's your city, where's your city, or where was your city? I think we have a marvelous opportunity in terms of this idea of global warming and stuff to step up and start doing something. But how does this fit in with what you've done?
Well, great question, and you know, it's funny how we played on words. And, you know, young guy from the Chicago suburbs, he was working with me, His name's Jesse Elliott, by the way. He left working with me. He has a fabulous band called These United States. They have their new album out. They were an NPR Song of the Day. We were talking about, like, where's your city? What would your city be? And he's just like, no, Rich, who's your city? You know, it kind of takes it. It's not a play so much on who's your daddy, but the play is, you know, who is, what is, who is, which city's personality reflects you. So we just thought it was great, and we actually fought with the publishers to have that title. On the issue of global warming, boy, oh, boy, you're absolutely right. And it's a terrifying issue. Just two quick things. One, what we're finding is that actually denser cities, which have public transit and where people live in condos rather than in big houses, are actually more energy efficient than the sprawling suburbs. So more urbanization tends to be, all other things equal, better for the environment. The second thing that the book talks about, which I think is just so interesting and so important, if you want to look at leadership on any of these issues, but particularly issues like global warming and climate change, it ain't, sorry for my English, it ain't coming from national political leaders. It certainly is not coming from the Congress, President Bush or Dick Cheney. The mayors are the leaders on this. The mayors are the one. Whether it's a Rich Daley, whether it's a Mike Bloomberg, whether it's a Gavin Newsom, John Hickenlooper in Denver, your own mayors, these are the folks that are getting out in front of these issues. And I think if you really want to talk about public policy innovation that goes beyond party, you know, Barack, who I admire so much, talks about a postpartisan agenda. These mayors are beyond party. And they're the ones really digging in their city saying, if the mayors could be in charge of our climate change agenda, we'd be in a much better place today than leaving it in the charge of the Congress and the president. So thank that caller for that comment, and I agree.
Okay, well, let's go on to someone here who is on the road, I believe, on line number one. Hello.
Yes. I want to follow up, actually, with social policy and with that last call. Something that I've noticed, because I have a lot of African-American friends and been spending a lot of time on the South Side of Chicago, is that the South Side is becoming gentrified, and there's a large movement of black people out that might have started with the tearing down the raising of the large projects, but a lot of people think that there's a policy to move the poor out of the large cities, Chicago, New York, and then I've heard that debunked. And but we are getting a lot of poor coming out of Chicago down our way, and it's not very good for them. It's good for somebody. Somebody's making a lot of money by gentrifying the city, but it's not good for the poor. And so I have, I guess, a number of questions, but one of them is part of the policy getting the poor out of the city of Chicago?
I think that's a great question, and I don't even think you need policy. I think the nature of the world is spiky, the nature of the concentrating forces in the world economy, the fact that these big cities are driving the idea-driven economy, the fact that affluent people, it's not that they want to live in an apartment in a bustling city because it's cool. They want to live close to downtown and in these neighborhoods because they can't afford the time cost of a long commute. So they're saying, you know, if I'm going to be effective and productive in my field, and I have one or two children, or maybe none, I'm going to live close to that city center where all the action is. And so it's even more insidious. It's simple market mechanisms that are leading to this wholesale transformation of some cities. This is not happening in Detroit. It's not happening so much in Pittsburgh. It's not happening in Buffalo. But indeed, it is happening in Chicago. It's almost completely happened in San Francisco. It's happening in New York and in Washington, D.C., where I lived for a long time. It's happening every day. You can see a neighborhood become transformed with its indigenous residents pushed out. I think what we have to understand is the way these markets work and develop policy responses that make sense in light of those market forces. And as I was saying to a previous caller, this is precisely what we're trying to do in Toronto. And if you want to look at a city that's trying to actually do this, that's saying it's not simply that we can allow the market to take over every neighborhood. that we can actually think about a plan and a strategy for our city so we can have a balanced population. We can have low-income people, middle-income people, affluent people, and they're not all angry and mad as heck at one another and fighting all the time. So, yes, it's achievable, but I think unless we take a good look at how this market is spatially and geographically polarizing us, but it's not like government is actively doing this. If government is doing it, it's doing it by benign neglect, not by active intervention. It's more the kind of insidious workings of an unregulated market that are sorting us in these ways, which I think are both economically challenging, but also socially very divisive and politically very polarizing. And over the long run, those are the things that really worry me. Is this economically sustainable? Is it politically and socially tenable?
Well, it's also in Chicago, there are city policies that are following that growth at least. For instance, on the south side, not far from, I don't know if you know Chicago, but not far from the Museum of Science and Industry, the Park District is now going to build a new huge marina to accommodate the wealthy and their yachts. And the Olympic movement will take Washington Park, which is, if you go to Washington Park on a weekend, it's full of, in the summer, full of picnicking black families, and that park will be removed if the Olympics come to Chicago. And if it's not the Olympics, they'll probably do something else to service this movement. And it's not that the South Side has been some, wonderful bastion for poor blacks. It's not. But they're going to go somewhere. So this movement of poor is going to have impacts all around this megalopolis.
I know Chicago a little, and I know the South Side a little. I know Washington, D.C. even better. And let me give you an illustration of the Washington, D.C. problem that made me almost sick to my stomach. When the mayor said we needed to build a new stadium for a baseball team and took over a large part of a low-income neighborhood to do that, but not a single high school in the community, those serving low-income African-American people, had a ball field for kids to play in. I think when mayors begin to, and I don't know Chicago well enough in that situation to comment on it, but when mayors and political officials begin to make those kinds of choices, I can only say they're tragic. They're divisive, and I don't want to push too hard on this, but if you go to Copenhagen or Stockholm or come for a visit up to Toronto, we are not making decisions like that. We're making decisions to support neighborhoods. Oh, of course you want to have certain areas where wealthier people can afford an apartment and increase density. You don't want to push them out of the city, but we're making sure that historic neighborhoods aren't overturned. We're taking great care to make sure there's affordable housing for low-income people. We're making sure through social policy that we don't have the truly underclass people. So these are all solvable problems. They're not solvable in any minute, but if you pay attention and you care about them. And I just think it's tragic, as an American, to watch this process again in cities that are becoming fabulously wealthy, like Chicago or New York or Washington, D.C., what the caller's saying, to have low-income people pushed around, moved. My father's, and why this is so important, I guess so resonating with me, is my dad, when I was a young boy, used to take me by the house. It wasn't a house anymore, it was a highway, where he said he was born, that was now a major U.S. interstate. And he said, Rich, they condemned our house through eminent domain, and they plowed it over, and we had to move out of our, Little Italy kind of Italian ghetto in Newark. And so my folks had to find a new place. So this kind of stuff resonates with me, and I find it quite tragic. I only hope through this book and through my own work and work with mayors and communities that we can help to put more light on it. But the caller really resonates with me, and maybe American cities need to take a look abroad at some of the more interesting things that are happening in other countries.
We have about 5 minutes left. Our guest is Richard Florida. He's professor of business and creativity at the University of Toronto and is the author of the recently published book, Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just something I'm curious about, you mentioned a little bit earlier, here that for people who are thinking about moving and if they're looking for prospective partners, you actually have a map in the book that show that maps out where are the greatest concentrations of single men and women. And interestingly enough, all the guys are in the West and all the women are in the East. And I'm really curious about, you know, if you're a woman looking for a male partner, I think you want to go to Southern California. And if you're a man looking for a female partner, you want to go to the corridor there that's the New York and whatever all Philadelphia and whatever all else it is. Why is that? Why is it that it's that by gender we seem to have this this geographic polarization?
Well, I talk about that at great length in the book. I just want to point out one more thing. The Midwest also is good for guys, and Chicago area is good for guys, and greater Detroit. And I note in the book, you know, kind of humorously, that I met my wife outside of Detroit. Now, I didn't have a singles map, but I met my wife, and, you know, I kind of asked her. We went out one night, and I said, Rana, why are there so many more kind of eligible single women kind of in greater Detroit? And she looked at me and she said, well, Richard, are you clueless? The men move for economic opportunity. The women stay behind a greater proportion because of ties to family and friends and nieces and nephews. And so I just laughed. The other explanation, of course, is that on the East Coast and in many major cities where you see women, you know, kind of more women than men, there's a great young economist at Columbia, Lena Edlund, who's actually done a paper on this. She said that men are moving for economic opportunity and women are following. In some senses, there's also a great job market for women in these big centers, but also following more eligible men. So there you find in Washington, D.C., which has one of the highest ratios of women to men, you find women have great economic opportunity, but there's also a better pool of eligible guys. Out on the West Coast, I think it's always been a pioneer society. It's always been a place where kind of the highly mobile went, has lots of new immigrants, which tend to be male, more or less. And maybe the occupational profile was biased a little bit more towards men. But I think, you know, if you're a young woman, certainly if you're looking at a place that your odds are better. And, you know, on our blog, we talk about this all the time at whosyourcity.com. You know, where should I go if I want to find the person? It's pretty funny to be a professor talking about this, but people write in all the time, where should I go to find the person of my dreams? And, you know, now I know why my dating life isn't so good, because I live in a market that's not great for me. So it's pretty funny, but I think it's also relevant.
Yeah, you get to make money doing that.
You know, who knows? The other thing I wanted to point out for folks is we did this big survey with the Gallup organization, 28,000 people, and one of the things we found is that there's three things in your life that make you happy. One is your social relationships, your family, your life partner, your friends, being close to them. The other one is having a job and career that's fulfilling. But the third one is living in a place that you really love. And that was quite surprising to us. And two things that really matter to people in their places, just for folks listening out there, we want safety, we want security, we want good schools, we want a great mayor. But two things that are really quite important is cities that are kind of aesthetically beautiful, and you know, if that's a rural area, a village, a town, a city, great lakes, great mountains, clean air, great stuff to do, good restaurants. And the other thing is cities that are open to different kinds of people. We found on balance that people are happier, whether they're black, white, Hispanic, Latino, Asian, young, old, gay, or straight, in cities that are more open to various kinds of people. On balance, the people who live in a diverse city are happier than those that don't.
I'll try to get real quick one more caller here in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm wondering if you have anything to say about New Orleans and particularly government policies relative to New Orleans.
Talks about two things. Government policy has been an abject disaster because it's focused on rebuilding the central business district. When we asked people in New Orleans, literally a month before Katrina struck, what really matters to you in New Orleans, they told us two things. Our church and the nightlife areas that we go to, bars, taverns, pubs, coffee shops, hangout places in our neighborhoods. They had a higher level of love for those things in their city than any other city in the country. What are we not rebuilding? The churches and religious institutions that people resonate to, and those local third-place nightlife destinations that are part of their life. We're rebuilding the central business district that they really couldn't care care less about in the interest of kind of tourism and economic growth. So I think there's a smart way to rebuild New Orleans, and kind of the current way to build New Orleans, they're at odds with what the people of New Orleans before Katrina said they wanted.
We're just about out of time. I know we've talked about the fact that for a lot of people, their reasons to move in their life are to go to college, perhaps. Then the next big reason to move would be for work. Once people get established, maybe the idea of moving gets a little bit more difficult. But I wonder if you think that more people at later on through the life course, particularly once we get to the point where children are gone, more people are going to be thinking about moving and perhaps thinking in a deliberate way, as you suggest, looking at what kind of place they want to live and then looking for a place that fits that description.
My real goal for this book, people said, you know, college students should buy it. I think that's right. They should buy it for their parents. And I really do. And I think with the baby boom, now the elders hitting 60s, the youngers in the 50s, maybe the late 40s, I think this generation that's highly mobile, in relative good health, has a lot of built-up wealth, and typically doesn't want to grow old, moreover, really wants to follow their kids. I think instead of moms and kids moving home to the moms and dads, what you're going to find is moms and dads moving to the kids to be part of that vibe and that excitement. I think this is where you're going to see a big change. In the past, the young person was 5 to 7 times more likely to move than someone in their 50s. I think with the baby boom, that's going to change. And this bulging boom of people who have more economic resources than any generation before are the ones who are really going to be strategically picking where to live. What worries me about that is, boy, oh, boy, it's going to make it a lot harder for a young person, a whole lot harder for a young person to establish themselves unless mom and dad can help them, because that baby boom is not only going to be picking places to live, it's going to be picking attractive places to live around young people, and that might, even in a housing slump over time, drive up some of the prices. So I think, yes, in the future, the baby boom is going to be a big part of who's strategically choosing where to live.
All right. Folks want to read more on the subject, look for the book, Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life, by our guest Richard Florida. It's published by Basic Books. There's a website for the book, whosyourcity.com. Also, if you'd like to learn more about him, you could look at the website creativeclass.com. Richard Florida is professor of business and creativity at University of Toronto, where he is also academic director of the Martin Prosperity Institute. And Professor Florida, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, David. Thanks to all the callers. And, you know, on the website, if you want to play with it, folks, there is a place finder which allows you put in 3, 4, 5 cities you think you might like and generate an output. And write into, if you want comments, you can find me at florida@creativeclass.com. Participate in the blog, and I look forward to interacting with each and every one of you. And thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, great. Thanks. WILL programming made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2008 series presents Shakespeare as a Skywatcher, Joining Astronomy with English Literature by David H. Levy. That's today at 7:30 this evening at the Beckman Institute. More information available online, www.cas.uiuc.edu. That's it for us. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, our guest will be a neuroscientist. We'll talk with him about the human brain. His name is Sam Wang, and he is co-author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive, and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat trading at 11.10 and a half. That is up 42. In Chicago, May wheat 10.60 and a half, up 40 and one half. July 10.59 and a half, up 41. May corn 5.43 and a half, up 18 and three quarters. July 5.55, make that 5.56, up 19. September 5.59 and a half, up 19 and a half. December 5.58 and three quarters, up 19. May soybeans 1307, up 50. July 1322, up 50. August